and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and we're bringing you our feature in-depth interview followed by some new music from Ukraine. This week's interview is with global political analyst Michael Butsurkiv. Bohdan Mihailo talks with Michael on his take on the latest events in Ukraine. That will be a little bit further on, but first of all, this week's news. EU leaders extended punishing economic sanctions against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine for another 6 months, amid heightened tensions over the Azov Sea clash. The EU President Donald Tusk tweeted from a summit in Brussels that the EU unanimously prolongs economic sanctions against Russia, given zero progress in implementation of the Minsk agreements. The sanctions target whole sectors of the Russian economy, including its valuable oil businesses. NATO will supply Ukraine's military with secure communication equipment this month. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told President Petro Poroshenko, who called to discuss an escalation of Kyiv's conflict with Moscow. It is part of a €40 million or $46 million pledge by the Western Military Alliance to strengthen Ukraine's armed forces. Stoltenberg said the secure communications equipment would be delivered by the end of the year. Russia has been ramping up its forces near the border with Ukraine since August and now poses the greatest military threat since 2014, the year Moscow annexed Crimea, said General Viktor Muzhenko, commander of Ukraine's armed forces, in a statement to Reuters. General Muzhenko provided a series of satellite images, which he said showed the presence of Russian T-62M tanks stationed 18 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. Their number had more than doubled, from 93 to 250 vehicles within the space of 2 weeks, which was from mid-September to the 1st of October. There will be no meeting between the US President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin while Russia still holds Ukrainian ships and sailors seized near Crimea, US National Security Advisor John Bolton said. Russia seized three Ukrainian Navy vessels and their combined crew of 24 last month off the coast of Russian-annexed Crimea and accused them of illegally entering Russian waters. Two Ukrainian Navy captains being held in a Russian jail have refused to provide testimony because they consider themselves prisoners of war. Two Ukrainian Navy captains being held in a Russian jail have refused to provide testimony because they consider themselves prisoners of war. Roman Mokryak, the commander of one of the gunboats, told Russian investigators he would not provide any information until his crew was released, his lawyer Ilya Novikov said. Oleg Melnichuk, the captain of the tugboat, has also refused to testify, denying Moscow's accusations and calling himself a prisoner of war, according to his lawyer, Edem Sebendlyayev. No date has been set for the sailors' trial. The European Parliament awarded Ukrainian filmmaker and political prisoner Oleg Sentsov the 2018 Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought on the 12th of December. Sentsov's cousin, Natalia Kaplan, and his lawyer, Dmitry Dinze, traveled to Strasbourg, France, to accept the award on his behalf. Sentsov has been imprisoned in Russia's Siberian Arctic since his arrest in 2014 for supposedly leading a terrorist organization in occupied Crimea. Ukrainian priests will meet on December the 15th for a sobor, to work towards an independent church in what Kyiv authorities hope will be a step further out of Russia's orbit. The meeting will seek to implement a landmark decision by Istanbul-based Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I to recognize Ukraine's independence from the Russian Orthodox Church. The clergy will elect a head of a new united independent Ukrainian church. The new leader will receive the Tomos, a special document which officially recognizes the independence of the church. And this will come from the Ecumenical Patriarch in Istanbul on January the 6th, which is right on Orthodox Christmas Eve. Vasily Lomachenko defeated Jose Pedraza to unify his lightweight titles. The winner said afterwards that he would like to stay the course towards unification at 135 pounds, calling out the undefeated Mikey Garcia by name while still in the ring. "Maybe next year we can fight against Mikey Garcia," he said. "One name, one belt."
Well, I'm very happy to have in our studio for Ukraine Calling Michael Butyrki, who's been a guest on our program before. Mike is a very well-known global affairs analyst, former spokesperson for the OSCE here for the mission in Ukraine, worked also for UNICEF, among others. And I congratulate you, Michael, that you have become one of the most prominent spokespersons for these broad-ranging global affairs issues, humanitarian issues, but also issues of concern to Ukrainians. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And first question, what brings you back to Ukraine again?
Well, it's almost a tradition for me to come at this time of year to Ukraine. It so happens that on Friday, this Friday, is the annual award ceremony that was initiated by my late aunt, my dear aunt, Anastasia Shkilnik from Canada. And it's called Svitlo Spravodlivosti. It's an award for ethical, moral, spiritual leadership. Past awardees have included Yevhen Svestyuk, Mustafa Jamilov, and last year, a dear friend of mine received the award, Natalia Sedletska of the Shol Scheme. And of course, so happens right now, we find ourselves in a very uncertain time for journalists, not only here in Ukraine, but worldwide. So we're all thinking of Sedletska and her team. They do terrific work. And then also, I was here attending the Tiger Conference, speaker last year, just a participant this year. And very interesting, Bogdana, because few things came up this year. One was high tech. It's kind of the new darling or star of the Ukrainian economy here, creating tons of jobs.
And everybody seems to be talking about it.
Everyone is, including last night where I saw you at the British Ukraine Chamber of Commerce. So, but it's great to see this bright light in the Ukrainian economy, which is otherwise not doing very well and not being helped by martial law, I should add. But, you know, Bogdana, we talked earlier about some of the changes I've seen in Ukraine. And the Tiger Conference, it wound up with the annual Top 30 Under 30 Awards.
Just to remind listeners, yeah. So the Tiger Conference is run by the Kyiv Post.
Correct.
It's an annual event, brings together some of the top speakers and experts in various areas, but it also gave prizes to 30 of the most successful under 30 people in this country.
Correct, yeah. And during the awards ceremony, about three or four of the young kids, of course they're all under 30, rejected the award on the basis that it was sponsored by Viktor Pinchuk, of course, one of Ukraine's richest oligarchs. And you know, in discussions afterwards with participants, we were wondering, you know, these are young folks, and are we seeing the beginning of a kind of anti-oligarch mentality here in Ukraine?
Well, I think we've been seeing that for a long time, and then the Maidan was about that. It's just that it hasn't gelled and come together properly. But it was interesting. I also was present, as you noted, that these protests, if you want, this refusal to take a prize from an oligarch, even if well-meaning, it was done in his presence.
It was. And I think that will kind of stick with him. If, you know, he's one of the more visible of the oligarchs, the half dozen or so that are still running around here in Ukraine. He does the annual Yes conference, which is very visible. But, you know, there's such disparities in the Ukrainian economy. You have people making struggling to make $100, $200 a month. And then you have these rich billionaires. So, I mean, in fairness to him, it's good to see that part of his fortune, if you will, goes to these types of events, which does award, you know, young entrepreneurship.
And who impressed you the most of the younger people?
Well, I think all of them had some really good stuff going for them. And also there was a book ceremony where one of the young ladies, 17 years old, I believe, declared, I'm going to become president of Ukraine. Well, that is something you don't hear every day, especially from young people. So that was good to see. And she actually had a platform, you know, to present. So that was a bright light. Also, I should add, one of the panelists very impressed me was the deputy mayor of Dnipro city. She also advises, I believe, the mayor of Lviv and others, half Estonian, half Ukrainian. But, you know, she was very articulate and very energetic. And just quickly, I went up to her and, you know, introduced myself and said, do you have any aspirations to go to national politics? She goes, no, I'm happy where I am, municipal politics, because that's where my decisions affect people the most directly.
Very good. Well, Michael, you've been very active outside of Ukraine. And in fact, one of your recent pieces was about the introduction of martial law here in response to Russian aggression in the Kerch Strait. So what were you saying, basically? Remind us.
Right. Well, I wrote quite a hard-hitting piece on CNN for CNN Opinion, and then I did a interview with Rosemary Church on CNN International. And, you know, I didn't hold back at all. I thought the timing was terrible. I thought the timing was also suspicious, it coming so soon before the presidential G20. Election. G20, but also one wonders, and believe me, this isn't only my opinion. I've talked to many local Ukrainian friends here who say, why wasn't martial law introduced into 2014 when Eastern Ukraine was taking over Crimea or during some of the other high points, if you will, during the conflict? So, but look, you know, we've been talking a lot this week about the economy and investment, and this is just the worst thing that could be introduced right now for the Ukrainian economy. In fact, I understand the government roadshow was canceled this week. That was supposed to happen in Berlin. You know, who is going to invest in a country where they have martial law? What kind of tourists are going to come in a martial law type of environment? So I'm not quite sure whether they calculated all of this. Now, having
Michael, but you know, you're in full flight right now, you know, being on top of these subjects. But one thing that I observed is that this slow, gradual strangulation of the Sea of Azov has been going on for almost half a year. And I've been rather disappointed and surprised by the very weak responses of official Kyiv to this. You know, suddenly there's this great reaction to the boats being seized and the sailors being taken prisoners of war. But why wasn't there a very active campaign to alert the West to what was happening?
One wonders. One wonders indeed. And why has it taken so long to build up the capacity, the resilience of the Ukrainian Navy as well? And I noted in my CNN piece is that it took quite some time for Poroshenko to accept these naval boats that was donated by the United States that would have boosted capacity of the forces there. Look, I'm not going to gloss this over whatsoever. It's clear what is happening in that part of the world in the Azov Sea is that it looks like, you know, with the construction of the bridge, the strangulation of the Ukrainian economy there, that Putin is intent on taking over that that sea, which, by the way, is the size of Switzerland. It's huge, but it's very strategic location.
And yes, and perhaps as people have been speculating for a long time, and political analysts warning that he wants this land corridor to Crimea to secure water supplies to Crimea from Dnipro, but also, you know, more or less to take over or neutralize the ports of Mariupol and Berdyansk.
Yeah, and you know, the reaction of the West has been very muted. Of course, there was a lot of strong rhetoric, including from Chrystia Freeland, my foreign affairs minister in Canada, but those words weren't backed up by actions. And this is a theme I've been talking about and writing about for quite some time, is how thug regimes, authoritarian regimes have really been acting very harshly with abandon, I would say, whether it's in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Yemen, in Ukraine with the Russians, with their aggressive actions in Ukraine. And I think people like Putin, like the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS, know now that they can act and not suffer severe consequences. So that's very, very disappointing.
So, Michael, why is that? Are we back in the mid-30s here, you know, in the age of appeasement where we had Mussolini and Abyssinia, Hitler getting away with, you know, land grabs and what, much going on, Stalin murdering millions in Ukraine. Why do you think, as somebody who covers these affairs so closely, why do we have this lack of, leadership and lack of backbone in the countries that have been the pillars of democracy, of the Euro-Atlantic structures, etc.
It's a very complicated situation, but I think a big reason is the collapse of American leadership, the biggest, strongest democracy in the world. Traditionally, the world's policemen, when it comes to enforcing the world's based rules. It's very sad to see what's going on because, you know, although we hear again outrage this morning, even from the American embassy towards the Nazarov case, we've heard Nikki Haley speak very strongly about the situation in Ukraine, but it's not backed up by action. So I think these authoritarian thug regimes can get away with it. And look what is happening in China right now. In regards to Canada, for example, we recently, at the request of the United States, arrested the CFO of Huawei, the telecoms firm. And China promised retaliation, even though things are happening according to the law. And right now, two Canadians have been detained in China, and they are acting the way they want to without following the law. It's very disappointing to see.
What could be done? What should be done by Ukrainians that may be listening, particularly younger Ukrainians, professionals, both in Ukraine, of course, but perhaps in the diaspora too, to strengthen the message? We seem to have come a long way since the Orange Revolution, Euromaidan and whatever. We've tried to get our act together to get the messages mm-hmm. across, but somehow we're not succeeding. We're failing.
Yeah, you know, it's a theme I talked about last year when I was here, at Tiger and elsewhere, is that I think one of the big problems is we have a lack of spokespeople, a lack of advocates, surrogates, whatever you want to call them, speaking on behalf of Ukraine. We've talked about this so much in the diaspora, you know, like having prominent actors or people from Hollywood even taking interest in the Ukraine issue, because there are Ukrainians there. But even the Ukrainian government does not have its act together whatsoever when it comes to advocacy. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples. I mean, name me now the spokesperson of the MFA in Ukraine. They lost their previous spokesperson. She was appointed ambassador. And now I don't see anyone speaking on behalf of the ministry except the minister himself. And then the other thing, Ukrainian embassies in key capitals.
And the president doesn't have a proper spokesperson.
No, he doesn't.
Like Putin has in, you know, with instant responses
yeah.
and
yeah.
tackling the press and having a kind of Michael Buchurku for the OSCE.
Right.
You know, it's obvious.
Yeah.
Is that because the president, you know, as a former foreign minister, is his own foreign minister?
Well, I think it's still very centralized type of structure here in Ukraine, and there's a lack of trust even in delegating things. And I was about to say is that, you know, in our key capitals around the world, Ukrainian embassies are so under-resourced and don't have proper spokespeople. So that's a big problem, I think, in terms of getting our message across. Now, just very quickly, has to be said that, you know, I whenever I can, I try and bring up Ukrainian issues in mainstream media. I am blessed to have this incredible platform, but I am finding it quite a struggle to get Ukraine on that news agenda.
But you also have to be very balanced in your reputations at stake. You're a Canadian, you're a professional, you've yeah. been linked, as I said, to the UN, to the OSCE. You can't simply come across as an apologist for Ukraine.
Right.
Particularly at a time when, for example, look at what's happened in the last two or three days with the Nazarov case,
mm-hmm.
Nazarov being freed, shall we say, effectively by a court, and then the MP Leshchenko and the head of Naboom being ruled to have acted illegally, to have shared information about Manafort's obtaining money from the secret slush fund that the Regions Party had. I mean, that's not good news for the outside world.
No, and let's just remind people what a crook Nazarov is. The former head of the state fiscal service, accused of embezzling $70 million. And case was pretty watertight. And this was...
That's almost as much as Manafort got.
There you go. And the case was pretty watertight and viewed as a kind of win for the anti-corruption forces here in Ukraine. And a court has reinstated him. With back pay, believe it or not. So
Michael, imagine you're on CNN or on mm-hmm. BBC, and I'm saying, Mr. Buchurku, what does this mean? Does this mean that only lip service is paid to the struggle against corruption? And why would the president afford such a risky political move through his influence on the eve of elections? Does it mean he's not taking the election seriously?
Well, one wonders how independent he really is. If he were to back up the promises he made on the stage at Maidan, where he kind of came to power, he would really go after these crooks, these thugs who have, you know, stolen millions, if not billions of dollars from the state treasury. But I don't think we've got to the point that has been demanded by Western donors, among others, of an independent judiciary here.
But many people consider that the tragedy is that the president himself is implicated. We don't want to go there too much, but there is a view, and it was aired recently by a former minister who was forced to resign, who was close to the president, who described Ukrainian politics and his role, the president's, as a person balancing interests between other oligarchs and being the primus inter pares, as opposed to running a nation, being presidential, seeing himself as a historic figure, uniting, speaking for the country, etc.
Well, look, he does come from the same club, if you will, of billionaires who've made their fortunes. And, I mentioned Natalia Sedlatska in her program earlier on, and they've busted him a couple of times now. One was that secret trip he took to the Maldives. And then the other was property holdings, I believe, in Spain, which weren't properly declared. So, you know, he does kind of appear to be one of these chaps from the Davos elite who is out of touch with the...
Also, toleration of pardon me, this is a sabotage, a frog in my throat already. But there's also, you know, the links with Firtash that continue, yeah. Medvedchuk, being so close to Akhmetov and balancing with Kolomoisky. And how is that to generate confidence both domestically and to support Ukraine's image and please to the outside world?
Yeah, well, look, Ukraine right now is so reliant on outside donor support from, you know, our traditional allies and the multilateral institutions that it has to show, it has to demonstrate that steps are being taken to combat, these corrupt schemes.
And yet, despite everything, it's just getting a tranche from the IMF. It's just receiving money, linked to conditionality from the EU again, a new tranche. So it's being given the benefit of the doubt, shall we say.
It is. And, you know, it has to be said that at the end of the day, a lot of this kind of stealing and corrupt schemes actually make matters worse here for the common man here in Ukraine that are still struggling. And, you know, at the Tiger Conference, we were talking about the severe, severe brain drain that is happening right now. Ukraine has lost millions of talented people to other economies. And a big reason that they say, because surveys have been done, is because of the corruption and the day-to-day struggle of surviving or, you know, putting up a business here, going through all that red tape. So, you know, if the young people don't have faith in the economy and the future of Ukraine, that does really worry me.
Yeah, the problem is, you know, it's not just the brain drain. Somebody was telling my wife yesterday about the shortage of engineers in this country. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the skilled labor have left because they're getting euros abroad or getting better conditions in Poland next door.
Well, there used to be a joke that the president of Poland could never find a plumber because they've all gone to London and are working in check-in desks at hotels there. But there's a shortage here. And in fact, one of the companies yesterday declared they want to double their staff here in Ukraine. But where are they going to find the talent, right?
So, Michael, looking ahead, okay. Mm-hmm. Do you see any grounds for optimism a few months down the road? Is this election going to be very dirty and disappointing? Or do you think that there are potential new forces, new faces that might eventually break out of this stranglehold that the oligarchs have?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's got to be said that the elections coming up at the end of March, presidential elections, are going to be among the most expensive in Europe. There's so many millions being spent. And in fact, there are already allegations that President Poroshenko is using administrative resources to gain more visibility and popularity.
Reasons the Minister of Finances was forced to, Danilyuk, who said that publicly, that funds are being diverted from the taxation system into giving local barons the money to bribe people locally with.
Yeah. But you asked about it. Are there any bright lights? So, I mean, of course. I mean, every time I come back here, I notice positive changes, whether it's to infrastructure, whether it's to new kind of services or attractions here in Kyiv. I mean, the amount of economic activity here is amazing. It's still a very, very safe place to come to visit. People are very hospitable. But I do worry, despite all of the efforts of our diaspora, of, you know, people like Ukraine Invest, you know, trying to get folks to come here to Ukraine.
Yeah, the great role that Dan Bilak does, yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very tough case to sell, this nation branding, when we have such corrupt schemes happening here, when, you know, you have things like martial law being declared. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, I put my faith in the young kids here.
Yeah, that was the hopeful note, very loud, that was sounded, as you've emphasized at the Tiger Conference. But the diaspora, if there are people listening, the organized diaspora, what should they be doing?
Yeah, two quick things. And one is actually doing what they have been doing traditionally is lobbying their lawmakers to keep Ukraine very high on the agenda and to tighten up those sanctions, to make them more targeted. There are other levers available that will squeeze, for example, Putin's circle in the Kremlin. And then, of course, it's very, very important that these issues be elevated in the media. We have a lot of Ukrainians in the media. Of course, there's a lot of other competitive stories out there right now, like Brexit and so on. But it's very, very important that ordinary people realize, and I'll maybe end with this, is that, you know, look, when someone was once asked, a prominent actor, about why we should care in places like South Sudan, why we should support them in various ways, diplomatically, financially. And he said, well, look, if we have a collapse of a South Sudan, it these things tend to have a knock-on effect. You know, they affect the whole region. And the same thing with Ukraine. It's got to be remembered. It's on the doorstep of Europe, huge country. And its success should be seen as very, very important, not only to world peace, but to the European economy, the European integration. So Ukraine is not an island. It's so now integrated into the rest of Europe. And, you know, again, I go back to what I said at the beginning, is that these actions that we're seeing happening have to be followed up with consequences.
Right. And finally, before I ask you for your parting thoughts or wishes, the support that the diaspora gives, should it also have an element of conditionality in it? I mean, unconditional support for an independent Ukraine and its territorial integrity, yes. But, you know, in times of political turmoil and uncertainty and rampant corruption, how do we deal with that?
That's a good question.
Should we be sending stronger messages from the diaspora?
Well, I don't think the diaspora or anyone else, for that matter, should be giving the Ukrainian government a pass for inaction, for example, against corruption, just because of patriotism. And, you know, I have to be honest with you, is that I've taken a few hits, a few knocks from the Ukrainian diaspora for what I've said and written, places like CNN. But, you know, this is the way the government has to be treated, is that if you don't live up to your pledges, especially those made on the stage of Maidan to millions of Ukrainians, that's why you were voted in, well, then...
And to the outside world.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, support us because we stand for change. We stand for principles. And...
Yeah, and then also, you know, here in Ukraine as well, I think, you know, the reaction I saw this morning from the U.S. Embassy and their tweets in regard to the reaction to the Nasirov pass, you know, reinstating him is really, really harsh. So I hope that's going to be a strong message for folks here.
Okay, Michael, and traditionally, you know, your parting thoughts, wishes to listeners, what idea or message would you like to leave us with this week?
Well, look, I'm not saying this just because I'm sitting here at Hromadske, but it's actually an outlet that I listen to a lot when I'm in Canada and Vancouver Island to keep up on things in Ukraine. And I really love the dedication in outlets like this and some of the smaller other media outlets here in Ukraine, because it really helps not only inform, you know, people like us in diaspora, people here in Ukraine, but it's also checks on abuse of power. As probably most of your listeners know, a lot of the mainstream media outlets here in Ukraine are controlled by those oligarchs we talked about earlier, or even Poroshenko owns a couple of stations at least. So to support outlets like Hromadske Radio, Hromadske TV, and other startups. And one more thing, the other thing the diaspora needs to lobby about is to finally push the government here to introduce a kind of PBS or NPR-style community radio here in Ukraine. It's so badly needed.
Which supposedly was on the cards a long time ago. Where has that money gone? And secondly, as I wanted to say at the Tiger Conference, shouldn't Ukraine be broadcasting into Russia? Shouldn't there be a voice of Ukraine, not propaganda, but actually telling the story? What are we up to in this country? What challenges do we face? What is the impact of the war on us? And secondly, perhaps, shouldn't the government be sponsoring, as a political gesture, a TV Free Russia or something?
Well, funny you should say that, because in a few hours I'm going to this so-called UATV, which is set up by the Ministry of Information. And I didn't even know it's broadcasting. I haven't seen it anywhere in Canada, but apparently they have satellite time. They're, you know, translating into different languages. Look, I think it's a little bit way too late. We should have, you know, the Ukrainian government and Ukrainian society should have got itself together.
But where is the accountability?
Yeah.
Do we know Who are the target audiences? How many people actually listen?
Right.
What are the carrots to dangle before the listener to make it interesting? How are you competing against Russia today with your very limited resources?
Yeah.
We hear nothing about that. On paper, this exists. But does it actually have an impact? Is the money justified?
Right. Yeah, it's very, very frustrating because, you know, again, last year at Tiger, we had this panel that I moderated on nation branding. And that was one of the big messages that came out of there, is that Ukraine is not getting its narrative out and it's not countering Russian propaganda. So these types of international broadcasting networks, if properly done, if properly resourced, could have a really, really big impact in terms of getting Ukraine's message out.
Well, thank you very much for that very stimulating and wide-ranging discussion. I've been talking to Michael Buturcu. Now I don't hesitate to say a distinguished and eminent global affairs analyst, and hope to see you again very soon on our program.
Thank you for happening. Thank you for having me.
I thank my parents for the happening. Андрію, якщо будеш слухати, додай це десь посередині, будь ласка. Бо я забув, ми так розговорилися, що я забув це, вставку таку. Let me just remind listeners that I am talking to this week's guest, Michael Buturcu, a distinguished journalist, spokesperson formerly for the OSCE, UNICEF and others, and now a leading global affairs analyst.
And this week's song is by a new Kyiv band called Cloudless. Their music was featured in Hromadske Radio's new live music show, Here and Now, and we thought you'd enjoy it too.
Принесла піски, день програмує на кров. подари, десь ніколи не пройти серед душі відкрити книг мої знайди.
Next week, we'll be back with more commentary on events in Ukraine with interview host Bohdan Mihailo. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you. You can write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.